Right. Good evening. Good to be back with you all again. We're going to be in the book of Nehemiah tonight, but we're actually going to get started in 2 Kings chapter 25. So if you have your Bibles, turn in your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 25. I get to teach through Nehemiah periodically with the youth and children's ministries. It's part of our curriculum, part of our programming over through the years. And it's something that the children's church is actually starting this month. So any children's church teachers in here, they're well-versed in it. And any of their kids that might be have just heard lesson one as well. But as far as our time together in here goes, I don't think it's actually ever been taught through. Internally, we have this document that dates back through 1974. That's over 50 years, and in it is every single person who has ever preached, morning or evening, and what they preached on. And Nehemiah is mentioned once in 1996 when we surveyed Genesis through Nehemiah. So while the kids' ministries might be well familiar with it, I don't think we've ever taken time to study it ourselves. Maybe you've taken time in your Sunday schools or home Bible studies, but in here, it'll be our first time. So I'd like to let the book be its own theme. We'll simply read it for what it is. It's a narrative. It tells the story itself pretty well. But along the way, we'll also take a note of the pattern of prayer in the life of Nehemiah. So Nehemiah is an excellent example, if not the example, of prayer and action. So on the topic of prayer, sometimes we debate among ourselves, why should I pray if God is sovereign? We know that we should pray, and we know that God is sovereign. It was a topic that actually just came up around the high school group. They asked, why do we need to pray if God predestined everything to happen? And these are good, hard questions. And the life of Nehemiah is the perfect answer to that sort of question. So as we read through it, we will take note of the instances that he prays to God and also takes action. Because when we pray, the next action isn't just to sit around and do nothing and wait on God to do his thing. There are steps that we can take to be faithful. Nehemiah, the person, is one of many examples we have in the Bible of faithful, patient, and prayerful leadership. He believes what God says is true. He habitually prays for God's hand to work in his life, even though he's the one maybe accomplishing the action physically. He's relying solely on God for the result. And with that reliance on God, he takes action in very creative and thoughtful ways. He doesn't just give it to God and take his hands off. He is very thoughtful and intentional with his decision making. So as we go through Nehemiah, just be listening for all the times that he prayed, and then he told God, then he asked God, and all those different situations were how he frames his life. So really what we're just going to do, we're just going to read chapters 1-6 of Nehemiah, and it will be pretty straightforward. But before getting into Nehemiah, I think it's important to know what happens leading up to chapter 1. In other words, just understanding why Nehemiah is going to be doing what Nehemiah is going to be doing. So where we are in history is 1,000 years after Moses and 400 years before Christ. In this particular moment in Israel's history, they have been exiled from their homeland for 70 years after the Babylonians destroyed it. So if you're in 2 Kings chapter 25, we're going to start in verse 9. And Nehemiah, he picks up at the end of this exile, when the Israelites slowly begin to return to the ruins of their land. So we get a summary of the destruction that occurred in verse 9. And he, referring to Nebuchadnezzar, burned the house of Yahweh, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, even every house he burned with fire. So all the military force of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, tore down the walls around Jerusalem. That last little part will be Nehemiah's focus here in our book. You can turn to Nehemiah chapter 1. So this Babylonian siege of Jerusalem is a critical turning point in the Old Testament. Your favorite Bible stories are often shaped by this moment and decision by Nebuchadnezzar through God's sovereign will to oppress the Israelites. The book of Daniel itself opens up with this exile. Daniel is deported and later goes on to work for Nebuchadnezzar. Ezekiel was later exiled as a result of this deportation, or the second deportation, I believe. And then Jeremiah, the prophet, he was still in Jerusalem at the time, but he prophesied of this exile. And then most recently, in our study at least, Esther, she was born in exile as a result of this. She was born into the Persian Empire, which just, they were the ones that succeeded Babylon. And that just shows you just kind of how far-reaching this moment was. So the destruction of Israel and following the deportation is what kicks off these biblical accounts. And now, Ezra and Nehemiah tells of the Jewish people's return from exile. First under Zerubbabel, there's a lot of fun names in the Old Testament, who led the effort to rebuild the temple. Then under Ezra, who restored God's law in Jerusalem, in Israel. And now under Nehemiah. So Jerusalem itself, it's in ruins. Once the Babylonians came in, it pretty much got left the way they left it. The temple's built, they have a law, and there's a very small number of Jews actually living in Jerusalem, the place that our story will take place. Israel, there's like 50,000 people that have returned to it over time, but Jerusalem itself is pretty lightly populated. And critically, they still don't have a wall around their city, and that's exactly where Nehemiah comes in, rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. So if you're in Nehemiah, we're going to start in chapter 1, verse 1. And it begins with Nehemiah in the capital where he works, a capital spelled like our capital building. Verse 1 says, "The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, that I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers and some of the men of Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and remained from the captivity about Jerusalem. They said to me, 'The remnant there in the province who remain from captivity are in great calamity and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire.'" So Nehemiah kicks off his book by writing down what motivated him to take action. He hears about his home, this home that he's likely never seen in his life. It's still in ruins. And in particular, its perimeter is still burned to the ground. And not only is the city itself in turmoil, but we'll learn later, so are the inhabitants. We'll get into it, but the inhabitants of Israel, at least the less fortunate, are being enslaved by the wealthy. The wealthy inhabitants, they're abusing their power virtually to the point of starving the poorer Israelites. So Nehemiah hears this news, and we see his reaction in verse 4. "It happened that when I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." So immediately, as will be the tradition in Nehemiah's life, he takes his problem to the Lord in prayer. For 4 months, he's praying. And we know it to be 4 months because in verse 1, we have Kislev, and in chapter 2, verse 1, we have Nisan, and those months are approximately 4 apart. So Nehemiah, he's in prayer and preparation after hearing this terrible news about his home for 4 months. And then the next few verses, we see what that prayer entailed. So first in verse 5, he starts off, by praising God for his faithfulness. Next in verse 6 through 7, he repents not only for himself, but on behalf of the people. It was, their wrongdoing that put them in this position in the first place, and he repents on behalf of them. And verses 8 through 10, Nehemiah proves that he knows the God he's praying to. And I bring this up because often in our world, people pray to a different God. They might believe it's, our God, but they have this false idea of him in their minds. They've kind of made up what they'd like God to be. But in Nehemiah's prayer, he understands God very intimately. He knows what his plans for Israel are. He's very familiar with what God's intentions are. And finally, in verse 11, we get his request. Says, "O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your slave and the prayer of your slaves who delight to fear your name, and make your slave successful today and grant him compassion before this man. Now I was cupbearer to the king." So this isn't, there isn't one formula to prayer, but this one definitely works, and I think it's worth highlighting. Nehemiah, who spent likely 4 months praying this prayer, structured it in this way. First, just praising God for his faithfulness. Second, he repents. Third, he demonstrates that he knows who God is. He's not just a guy in the sky looking to grant a wish. He knows who God is. And then finally, at the end of his prayer, he makes his request known to God. It's neat if you ever want to compare Matthew 6 to the Lord's Prayer, to Nehemiah's prayer, the parallels are neat. And the grammar used in verse 11 gives us an indication of when this prayer occurs. Nehemiah is about to go to work. We know that because it says, make your slave successful today and grant him compassion before this man. So where was Nehemiah headed off to work? He was a cupbearer to the king. The cupbearer, somebody who drank before the king drank that same thing, make sure there was no poison in it. It was a very respected position, lots of trust, lots of one-on-one time with the king. And Nehemiah, and it'll come into play here in just a minute, he has an in with the person in power. He sees him all the time. Now, if you remember our time in Esther on Sunday evenings not so long ago, you remember that it's important that you be an approved and a happy audience before a king, or it could mean your life. So Nehemiah, he's been praying now for a while about his presence before the king, that he would be granted compassion before him. And again, this prayer could have been repeated every day for 4 months, or maybe Nehemiah knew today was the day that he would bring his case before Artaxerxes. But either way, today is the day to speak with the king. So in chapter 2, we see Nehemiah lay out his plan, starting in verse 1. It happened in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Remember, this is his job. Now I had not been sad in his presence, so the king said to me, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. So I can assume that Nehemiah has been doing his job every day for the last 4 months. And I imagine just today might have just been a harder day. But up until this point, Israel, Jerusalem in particular, its perimeter, it's been weighing on his heart. He's been praying about it incessantly. But for whatever reason, something about today caused him to crack, and he wore his sorrow on his sleeve. And he knows better than to do that, because that's why he says at the very end of verse 2, I was very much afraid. So the king, his natural indication is, well, people should only be sad in my presence if they're sick. This person isn't sick. It must be a sadness of the heart. So I guess you can give credit to the king here for being emotionally aware. He recognized that it was a deep sadness. You know, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? So Nehemiah, in verse 3, he answers him and explains, you know, how can I be happy when I know that my home, it's decimated? So this is a big moment for Nehemiah. This months of planning, prayer, and preparation have been leading to this specific moment. And we're going to see that he was adequately prepared with an answer. You know, contrast to how we might handle a sad situation. When we receive bad news or something terrible happens in our life, it's easiest just to kind of take it, sit back, and sit in grief for who knows how long. But not Nehemiah. He's been working out a solution for weeks, now in the hopes of executing his plan. Verse 4 says, then the king said to me, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. You know, who goes with Nehemiah everywhere he goes? Before Nehemiah even opens his mouth to respond, who does he look to? God. And you can imagine the scene here. He's just been asked face-to-face a question by the most powerful man in present day here. And in the midst of that conversation, face-to-face, he prays to God, right in the middle of it. He's been preparing for months, but right in Artaxerxes' face, he still prays. He's steeped in prayer. His relationship with God is so strong that it's second nature. The moment he needs something, he gives it to God. And he's not just winging this opportunity. You know, sometimes we use prayer kind of flippantly. You know, I'm about to do something, pray real quick, and then leap of faith. Or, you know, it wasn't a, you know, well, I'll just pray about it and here goes nothing kind of situation. As we'll see here, Nehemiah was exhaustively prepared for this moment, for this opportunity to make his case. And what we know is he's very specific. We'll get to that in just a second. But what I'd like this to think about in contrast to this is sometimes when we have a problem, sometimes all we rest in is the problem. Sometimes it's the only thing that we've ever prepared is to articulate the problem. When somebody asks, like, oh, what can I do to help? You know, we don't have an answer. Not Nehemiah. He tells the king that he wants to rebuild his city. He tells him exactly how much time he's going to need off of work. And he requests these specific notarized letters that way he can pass through and get to Jerusalem. And he even puts in a word with the king's, it says, the keeper of the forest, that he could get some wood for the project. So Nehemiah, he wasn't praying that somebody else would solve all of his problems. He was ready to be used by God. And the king grants Nehemiah's request. So this is a very generous move by King Artaxerxes. But still, Nehemiah knows who's really in control. Verse 8 of Nehemiah chapter 2. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of God was on me. So project is approved. He can go now and rebuild the wall. Nehemiah, an Israelite who has never been to his home, who heard of the ruins of Jerusalem, who prayed and planned for months, who now has the king's approval, notarization, and resources, can go finally fortify Jerusalem. And remember, Jerusalem at this point in time, it's not just a ghost town, even though it looks like it on the surface, but people have been dwelling back in Jerusalem for several decades. So the unfortunate side effect of that is people are probably pretty accustomed to the way things look around them, the surrounding people included. Particularly, the Ammonites and the Samaritans did not mind that Jerusalem looked a little worse for wear. And that's where our antagonists for this narrative come in. Verse 10 says, then Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, and it was a very great evil to them that someone had come to seek the good of the sons of Israel. So these two men in particular, Sanballat and Tobiah, they will be the source of many of Nehemiah's issues as he tries to rebuild the wall. We don't know a ton about him. Sanballat, we know from scripture, he was well off, evidently had some level of status. Extra-biblically, we understand him to be the governor of Samaria. So not just some unhappy neighbor, but somebody with power. Then Tobiah, he had prominent family ties with the Jews. He had married in, which the Jews were not supposed to do. And in chapter 13, his status elevates to such a point that he even gets a room inside the temple. And Nehemiah later kicks him out. But then, I mean, just case in point for why God commanded the Jews not to marry outside nations. It's going to bring them all sorts of grief in these chapters to come. What we really need to know, though, about these two men, Sanballat, Tobiah, is they are against Nehemiah, and they're against God. So back to Nehemiah then. He arrives in Jerusalem and begins to quietly inspect the situation, the city that he has not seen in person yet. When it's dark, he ventures out to look, and in verse 14 it says that while he's looking, he can't even get through on the animal that he's riding. There's just so much debris in the way. The wall is in such ruins, the paths, the roads, the city itself is in such turmoil. He can't even properly navigate through to take a good look. And we're told in verse 16 that he did all this in secret and didn't tell anyone his intentions. Verse 16, chapter 2 says, now the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who were doing the work. So all we can do here is kind of speculate, but it's informed speculation about why Nehemiah kept it hush for a little while. First, we already know that he's under opposition. Sanballat and Tobiah, before Nehemiah even begins work, they're very unhappy with the plan. They consider it an evil. Secondly, I believe he's just informing himself before asking for help from the people. You know, it's not very good leadership if you go in guns blazing and you don't have firsthand experience of the situation itself. So Nehemiah, prudent, I believe, goes in to take inventory and not just blindly putting a plan into motion. So after Nehemiah has had a chance to witness the destruction firsthand, it's time to rally the troops. And this is when we get to see Nehemiah's people skills, his leadership qualities, because there's no leadership if there's no followers. Up until this point, he's demonstrated he's great at planning, but now we need to see how he can lead a group of people. Verse 17 says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the calamity we are in, that Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach.' And I told them how the hand of my God had been good to me, and also about the king's words, which he had said to me. Then they said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they strengthened their hands for the good work." So in verse 17, he starts off by just reminding these people of the situation that they're in. Again, they've been here for a long time. And sometimes when you've been living in your disaster for too long, you kind of get used to it. Or you can kind of think of when something is a mess or you have a real high stack of tasks. You know, how bad is it to just throw one other piece of trash on top, or one other task gets added, you know, you barely even notice. So these people have just grown accustomed to the aftermath that they've been living in for decades. So you look around at this mess and you think, I don't even know where to start. So why start at all? But in verse 18, Nehemiah reassures them that this effort won't be in vain. Again, on the outside, it looks hopeless. But he not only has the king's approval, but he says that God's hand is involved. So you can imagine if you've got your stack of tasks or this huge mess to deal with, and God offers personally to help and put his hand in it, that would be pretty exciting. Again, read verse 18. "And I told them how the hand of my God had been good to me, and also about the king's words, which he said to me. Then they said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they strengthened their hands for the good work." This is exciting. This is, you know, somebody new has come in. They have offered a solution to the turmoil that they've been experiencing. And we can sometimes relate to this kind of infectious excitement. Sometimes, you know, you don't even need to be really clued in to what's going on. They're all excited. Suddenly, I'm excited. You know, everyone is ready to put themselves to work. God is on their side. But almost in every situation in the Bible, when God is at work, who else is? Satan. Verse 19. "But Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, and they mocked us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' So I responded to them with a word and said to them, 'The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his slaves, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or remembrance in Jerusalem.'" It does not take a lot to discourage people, and Nehemiah knows that. I think that's particularly why he's quick to address Sanballat and Tobiah. You know, certain situations, they call for discouragement, these oppositions to be addressed, while maybe others you can disregard it and let people have their words. But all it takes is one negative comment to plant seeds in people's minds. You know, everything could be going great as far as these people are concerned. You know, they got the king's approval and God is on their side. But the moment somebody says something negative, it plants a seed. It can be discouraging, it can be divisive. So I think about that as it relates to, you know, the church. Growing up here, I was, you know, in the clouds, head in the clouds, so to speak. Everything was going well. I didn't expect anything to be wrong ever. I just assumed everyone was here having a good time with each other, fellowshipping. There was no drama, no trials, no anything in life. And we were all just happy and glad to be here. You know, this church, we teach the Bible. God has provided us with an amazing building. We have wonderful music, ministries, programs, you name it. I was just happy to be here. In my ignorance, I just assumed that everyone else was happy too. But did you know that not everyone thinks that Indian Hills is such a great place? That was news to me. As I got older, I started to hear more of these disparaging opinions. Surprisingly, a lot of people don't think Indian Hills is such a great place. And all the things I once thought were perfect and normal, never criticized in my life, were being criticized. You know, some people, they don't hold the views that we hold. The various decisions that are made around the building. The carpet, the classic example, has different opinions on it. And I sympathize with Andrew for the enormous amount of opinions there are for the music that's sang. Again, suddenly, there are just these opinions and comments from every direction, inside and outside. So it's important to guard yourself. It's important for Nehemiah to gather his people. Because what happens to me and all of us who are suddenly enlightened with criticism? Well, it can become discouraging. We may start to question the work that we're doing. You know, is this the right decision? Is this the right move? Is this wrong? Is this right? You know, it doesn't take a lot to cast doubt and introduce divisiveness into the minds and hearts of people. You know, on an individual level, I hope and pray that we can all do our best to, you know, guard our hearts, our emotions, bring it to God, and trust Him. But as the leader, it requires a different set of rules. Nehemiah needs to also not just look out for his own heart, but he's responsible for leading these people. So he needs to look out for their morale and everyone else he's leading. That's what a good leader would do. So when Sanballat and Tobiah, they're hurling insults and doubt at Nehemiah's team, it has to be treated seriously. He can't just let it go on. He needs to keep a close eye on his people. If they're going to be discouraged, they're not going to work, and they're not going to build their wall. So back to chapter 3 of Nehemiah. It details all the people, more than 75 individuals are named, that will take part in rebuilding the wall. We're not going to take time to read through every single name, but it's a very neat account, and it's encouraging that Nehemiah takes time to name so many people that are responsible for restoring the wall around Jerusalem. And he even calls out some people for their lack of help. You can see how many times in the verses here it starts with next to them, this person helped, and then next to them, this group of people helped, and working next to them was this person. You know, in order to rebuild the wall, you can't just call on the people you'd expect to help rebuild. In verse 1, we have priests. In verse 8, there are goldsmiths and perfumers. In verse 32, there are merchants. Both men and women are mentioned. So we can see it's not just your local expert. It's not the craftsmen, the carpenters, the people who just, you know, needed to work. People from all walks of life united together to rebuild this wall. And I couldn't help but kind of draw some comparisons to our VBS season that's coming up in just, you know, a few weeks at this point. Everyone gets involved for this common goal, for this common purpose, from various walks of life, just to execute that week for the kids. But some people, they are called out for their lack of contribution. Like in verse 5, it says, "Moreover, next to them, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not support the service of their masters." So there were people, in this case in rural Judea, that refused to be put to work. They just refused to get their hands dirty in this case. But this credit given by Nehemiah to the people in service is neat. And we could easily write a Nehemiah chapter 3 for our own body, just a long list of people and the ways that they serve in the various capacities. And in this passage, we also get to see some of the wisdom exercised. We see in verses 10, 23 and 28 through 30, at least six groups of people, they are tasked with making improvements just outside their house. So the thinking, you can even kind of connect the dots yourself here. If you are rebuilding a wall and the purpose of the wall is to protect you from outside forces, and you're sent to the other side, you'll put in effort. But if the part of the wall you're reinforcing is in your backyard, you're going to make certain that that wall is sound. So work has officially begun, and we have the collective effort of over 100 people restoring the wall. Construction is underway. And of course, when Nehemiah and his team finally get started, we get a word from Sanballat and Tobiah again. In chapter 4, verse 1, we're told that when Sanballat heard about the reconstruction, he's quite unhappy with it. "Now it happened that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and very vexed and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they complete it in a day? Can they bring the stones to life from the dusty rubble, though they are burned? So you can imagine, it's just a gross, self-gratifying scene. Sanballat reclining at his home with all of his rich friends, just complaining, commiserating with them. You know, do you see what the Jews are trying to do? Can you believe it? He says, you know, these Jews are feeble. Sanballat, he sees the Jews' situation as just hopeless and belittles every aspect of it. He calls them weak. He questions how could they possibly restore it themselves? Could they do it in a day? He likely even calls into question their authority to do so. And he goes as far as to question their ability to sacrifice, to glorify God. Now, he's probably well in tune with the history. You know, God, he put these people into exile. He allowed them to be taken. And now they're going to try offering sacrifices. And Tobiah, seemingly Sanballat's yes man here, he contributes his own insult to the conversation in verse 3. It says, now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down. Good one, Tobiah. But either way, Nehemiah, he becomes aware of this dispute, these begrudging feelings from Sanballat and Tobiah, and he takes offense to them. As a result, we talk about Nehemiah and prayer and action, we get an imprecatory prayer from Nehemiah. Verse 4, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in the land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have vexed the builders. It starts off with Sanballat saying he's vexed, and now that is felt among the workers, Nehemiah's team. So these sort of prayers, they can be difficult to navigate. I'm not going to spend time dissecting an imprecatory prayer tonight. I will note that nowhere in here does it indicate or not indicate that we are to pray in this way. It's a narrative. And also, Nehemiah isn't rebuked for praying in this way either. It is worth mentioning, though, this prayer is not completely answered as far as it's recorded in Nehemiah. Nehemiah, he was perfectly in his right to pray in this way, and we're permitted to pray for God's justice as well. So here in Nehemiah, he's just praying for God to act. He hands the situation over to God, which is, I think, the main principle to take from here. Nehemiah, he understands what's in front of him, the trial, the enormous task. Now people are ridiculing him. He just gives it over to God in prayer immediately. And after he prays, Nehemiah and the people, they get to work. Verse 6. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, and the people had a heart to work. So in some senses, the prayer was absolutely answered. The part that wasn't, and we'll see that, well, you would actually see that if you studied the rest of Nehemiah, Tobiah gets to move into the temple, so they weren't moved into a land of captivity, as he requested. But Nehemiah's team that was vexed is now having a heart to work. And this is alarming progress. We're not talking about months here, as we'll see further evidence of either. And we're just talking about weeks at this point to have built a wall to half its height. Just a few verses before, Sanballat and Tobiah, they're scoffing at the very idea of this uneducated, unexperienced group of people building a wall for themselves, being able to pull anything off. But now, they're halfway done. And it says they had a heart to work. This group isn't a bunch of people, dreading the morning when they wake up to go back to work and restore their wall. This isn't a job that, they're begrudgingly going about their task on. They're excited. They're finally restoring, cleaning up, and making a home for themselves that's capable of protecting them. But like a lot of situations, we might even find ourselves in. At the beginning, you might have all the motivation, all the zeal in the world, but as time goes on, it can become weary. And if you've been doing something long enough and somebody interjects, I don't want to be doing this anymore, suddenly doubt, weakness creep in. And like we talked about before, it can be very easy for the wind to be taken out of our sails. And it's in the face of that kind of discouragement that the leader is critical. If everyone is on the same page that, we just don't have the time for this, and there's no one spearheading the result, it would just fall apart. So Nehemiah has his work cut out for him. If things start going bad and leadership hangs their head in disappointment, it'll infect the whole group. And Sanballat and Tobiah, they know that. They understand how people work, and they're going to try just that, to discourage and harm the people. Verse 7 of Nehemiah chapter 4. Now it happened that when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repairs of the walls of Jerusalem went on, and that the places broken down began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them joined together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. But we prayed to our God, and because of them we stood a guard against them day and night. So Sanballat and Tobiah, they've become increasingly angry now at the sight of the progress that's being made. As a result, their tactics to thwart the progress of rebuilding the perimeter evolve. You know, first, it's a few comments here and there. They're disparaging people best they can. They've vexed the workers. You know, it's been a word that's been going on. They were just verbally trying to intimidate and shame the Jews for their efforts. You know, that never feels good. You know, when you're trying to work hard and somebody says something discouraging to you, it can be deflating. But the Israelites, they continued to build. They had a heart to do it. Their hands were strengthened. So now, the tactics from Sanballat and Tobiah and their friends, they escalate, and we have the threat of war. So if you and I were at a project and someone insulted us by saying, oh, you know, a fox could jump on it, you know, we could probably sleep at night. But now, it isn't just mocking and taunting. There is a very real chance that they have to defend for their lives. You know, suddenly this feud that you have isn't just mocking, isn't just, you know, hurting your ego and your motivation. Your life and the life of your family is at risk. So Israel is now under the threat of physical war. And it says that they want to stir up a disturbance as well. And we're going to see that. Just this psychological warfare, this paranoia that creeps in to this group of people. So it's one thing to be able to see the threat and visualize and understand it for what it is. It's another thing when the rumors start to spread and it starts just to permeate your mind and it infects your thoughts, and suddenly the problem, it grows bigger than it is in reality. So there's rumors, there's lies, there's theories of what's impending. And all that these people hear about are the happenings around them, and that their enemy could be anywhere. At any moment, they could attack. And this would be extremely stressful for the community. So what do? Pray and take action. Verse 9. In light of all this, they said, but we prayed to our God, and because of them, we stood a guard against them day and night. So as per usual, Nehemiah turns to God for deliverance. It's another great example for us. But this takes another level of effort from the people. You know, Nehemiah, he was able to spur these people on in the face of verbal abuse. But now, his people are physically straining themselves to make sure they never get caught off guard. There's just a lot more happening in their situation. And, you know, we know this type of exertion, you know, for a person, what it can mean. It's exhausting. Even if nothing ends up happening, this constant state of anticipation can be very draining. You know, it's like, you know, if you're on a long road trip, even you're driving for a long road trip, you're in a nice seat, maybe even have a seat heater on, but after you've made your stop after, you know, 6-7 hours of driving, you just feel exhausted. You could fall asleep on the spot. You know, physically, you're sitting down the whole time. But you've been alert the whole time. You've been watching for cars. You've been changing lanes. Your mind has been active. So now, in the case of Nehemiah and his people, they've been alert for days and nights, and they're not just trying to watch a road. They are looking over their shoulder, waiting to be killed. Beginning in verse 10, we see the effects of this strain and what it had on the people, as well as the physical toll of the labor itself. Verse 10. Then Judah said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Our adversaries said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. So the people doing the work, the builders here, they are becoming overwhelmed, both physically and emotionally. And Nehemiah, I mean, this is the worst case scenario if you're trying to lead a team. You know, it's one thing if you're physically exhausted. It's another if you're physically and mentally exhausted. They've been bearing this burden for weeks without relief. And, you know, we also have to imagine just the state of Israel itself. You know, Nehemiah couldn't get by on the animal he was riding. Plants, dirt have all piled up on top of the uncleared debris from the siege of Jerusalem itself. So we know, you know, preparing for a project can sometimes just be harder than the project itself. You know, if you've ever painted a wall and taped it off, that's the worst part. Rolling's the easy part. So to add insult to injury, as we just finished discussing, the workers are paranoid of an impending attack. It's not just physically laboring, it's mentally. Verse 11, again, our adversary said, they will not know or see until we come up among them, kill them, and put a stop to their work. So it isn't the case that Nehemiah and his men, they can, you know, look over the hill, they see the army approaching, they can all get geared up, ready to go. The visibility was abysmal to the point where the threat of an ambush could be any place, any time. And you can just see through the word here how mentally and physically exhausted these people are, constantly looking over their shoulders, and when they look over their shoulders, they can't really see anything because their views are just so obstructed. And if that wasn't enough, next here in verse 12, even the people not directly involved in this situation, they feel compelled to make their way up to Jerusalem and say, hey, you guys are about to be attacked. You know, we're receiving word. Verse 12, now it happened when the Jews who lived near them came and said to us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. So this picture here is you and your group of untrained laborers are hard at work restoring the thing that protects you from the outside world. But that outside world, obviously, they're not going to let that happen so easily. The world is hurling insults and threats at you the entire time. And now things have gotten so bad that it's like making front page news. These surrounding areas, they're coming to Jerusalem and saying like, hey, the word is out. Everyone is expecting Jerusalem to be attacked at any point in time, and you're not even going to see it coming. So hopefully, we can just see and understand here how widespread the panic around Jerusalem and in Jerusalem is. It is just this powder keg waiting to explode. Nobody knows when or how they'll be attacked. They just expect to be. The first thing most people do in a situation like this is, you know, throw up their hands, panic, maybe flee, run away. Maybe just give up. But as always, Nehemiah takes action. So let's take a look in verse 13 at his response to the situation he found himself in. It says, that I had men stand in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I had the people stand by families with their swords, spears, and bows. So first, Nehemiah gets very practical with the response to the situation. He addresses the immediate concern. There are still parts of the wall, a little worse for wear. These parts are lower than others. We need to station people at those points of the wall. Even still, though, remember what's been exhausting these people is not just the work itself, but the paranoia, this emotional turmoil. So what might give you some motivation in the midst of your anxiety? Well, fighting alongside your family. Then in verse 13, I had people stand by their families with swords, spears, and bows. So if it does come down to all-out war and, you know, you're feeling a little tired, you're not really in the mood for it anymore, suddenly, if the person next to you is your family, you're going to fight tooth and nail. Doesn't matter how tired you are. That's going to give you all the motivation you need, and Nehemiah knows it. There's just one practical step Nehemiah takes. And next, he needs to address the emotions of the people. You know, they are untrained. They're demoralized, they're afraid, and, you know, assigning guard posts is one thing. But now it's time to inspire the people. You know, what good is your team if they have no motivation to go about executing the plan? Now, you can just imagine Nehemiah's point of view here. He's looking out into a crowd of, again, not perfectly adequate wall builders. You know, they're probably dressed in hand-me-down armor. Nothing fits properly. The helmet's a little cockeyed, and they're just scared. Verse 14, "Then I saw their fear, and I rose and I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, 'Do not fear them. Remember the Lord who is great and fearsome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses.'" Now, this is one of the best pregame locker room speeches in Scripture. You know, any amount of inspiration that you can remember receiving from your coach before your game does not compare to this. Nehemiah recognized they fear man. They're afraid of what man can do to them, and they can do a lot to them. So he gathers the people all together and encourages them the godly way a leader would. First, he reminds them whose hand is on the situation. You know, going back all the way to Nehemiah chapter 2, he kicked off the campaign by saying, "God's hand is with us." Yeah, Artaxerxes, he signed off on it too. But God's hand is with us. He will give us success. So people, you know, you're afraid of who might be hiding on the other side of the wall. You're afraid of, you know, all the possible angles that this enemy might attack you from. But what does he say? "Our God is great and fearsome." You know, who should be afraid in this situation? The enemy. Next, Nehemiah reminds them of what they have to lose. Not only do you need to remember that the Lord your God is great and fearsome, remember who you're fighting for. You know, the people of Jerusalem, they're not just doing a nice thing for Nehemiah. This is their home. This is where they reside. Their families are here. So he reminds them, end of verse 14, "Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." And the speech works. The speech works to such a degree that the people get back to work. It leaks that the Israelites, they've become aware of the impending attack. So maybe this ambush that they were planning. And Sanballat and Tobiah, they cancel plans as a result. All of Jerusalem, they're prepared, geared up. The plan is foiled, and Nehemiah and his team can return to work. Verse 15, Nehemiah chapter 4 says, "It happened that when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had thwarted their counsel, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. And it happened from that day on, half of my young men carried on the work, while half of them took hold of the spears and shields, the bows and the breastplates, and the commanders were behind the whole house of Judah." Verse 17, "Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried the burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me." Once again, prayer and action. It is all over the book of Nehemiah. So Nehemiah and his team are continually prepared for battle. They're constantly waiting. They're anticipating attack at any given moment in time. And does anyone read this and think Nehemiah lacked faith? You know, all this preparation, you know, what's it for? He prayed to God. You know, sometimes, and I can be prone to this too, we can turn our noses up at preparation and think, well, you gave it over to God. Now it's his to deal with. Why prepare? If Nehemiah truly had faith that God would take care of him, why does he do so much? Why is he sending people to work, half of them to work and the other half to protect full time? And even the workers are strapped. We have to remember that God may use us as instruments to accomplish his will. We might be the answer to a prayer. And that's the way Nehemiah operated. He prayed, but that didn't mean that he let his guard down. Nehemiah prayed, and yet half the men remained fully armed. Those who were building had a hammer in one hand and a weapon in the other. You know, on the topic of preparation, I do think you can overprepare, and it would be a symptom of a lack of faithfulness. But we can't just be dormant. I think each person has to do what they think God would have them do. At the very least, you just can't be lazy once you've prayed to God. Prayer and action. pray and be ready for God to work through you. And we even get a little bit more of that in verse 19 through 23. It says, I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, there gather together with us. Our God will fight for us. So we kept doing the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars came out. In that time, I also said to the people, let each man with his young man spend the night within Jerusalem so that it may be on guard for us by night and a worker by day. So neither I, my brothers, my young men, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon even to water. Nehemiah is ready for battle at any given point in time. You can't take your shoes off when you get done with work. You are sleeping in jeans. When you hear the trumpet sound, I will race you to the battle. In this portion of scripture, we see another example of how we can play an active role in God's plan. You know, back in chapter 2, when Nehemiah says that God will give them success, does he for a moment think that he can just sit back while God rebuilds the wall? No, he goes off and begins to rebuild the wall. Now here, the wall around Jerusalem, it's estimated to be about like 2.5 miles long, and people are all scattered around it. They're building various parts. And you can imagine communication is poor. There's no way to, call someone at this point in time. So Nehemiah's plan is, when you hear the trumpet, everyone, no matter where you are, no matter what you're working on, stop and meet wherever the trumpet sounds. What does Nehemiah say, though, at the end of verse 20? And this is a lot of preparation and effort by man to take action. Verse 20, at whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, there gather together to us, our God will fight for us. Perfect. If you could summarize Nehemiah's attitude in just a few verses, I think this is it. It is a clear example of faith and prayer just paired with action. It's an amazing example for us to take action and do whatever we can and trust that God will accomplish his will. You and I, we can do all we want, and I think maybe even should do all we can to prepare, but when it comes down to the results, you give that to God. And that wraps chapter 4. Nehemiah chapter 5, it's a bit of a deviation from the narrative that we've been following. In the midst of Nehemiah dealing with a life and death situation, rebuilding the wall and defending the city, he has to sort out these civil issues that come up among the Jews. For our purposes tonight, we're just going to highlight a few of the quick details from this chapter. The situation in chapter 5 is that the rich are exploiting the poor by means of like high interest loans. The situation is becoming unsustainable for the poor to such a degree that they are on the brink of starvation. People are having to mortgage their property just to buy basic necessities, and they're having to force their sons and daughters into slavery. So while Nehemiah is dealing with all of this on the highest level, people in their civil issues are still dealing with this. In verses 8 through 13, Nehemiah, he holds an assembly with all of the nobles and their leaders, and thankfully, these wealthy elites, they're receptive to the rebuke, and they agree to forgive any debts and return what once belonged to others. It's a quick resolution, praise God, because Nehemiah is busy. And as a result of this experience, what's worth taking a look at, definitely on your own time, is verses 4 through 19. Nehemiah takes a break from the main narrative and talks about what happens over future years. In short, unlike his predecessors, he never takes from the people. As governor, he had the right to take an allowance from everybody, from food to money to whatever, but he doesn't do any of that. And his motivation for all this sacrifice should be the same motivation for you and I when we make sacrifice. Is he doing it to receive thanks from man? Is he in Jerusalem to receive all the authority and attention once he resurrects these walls? Is man ultimately who Nehemiah is serving? Verse 19 of chapter 5 says, remember me, O my God, for good according to all that I have done for this people. Throughout his entire project, Nehemiah is constantly most interested in pleasing God. He knows that the reward for pleasing God far outweighs any reward he could enact on these people, taking their allowance as governor. And hopefully, that's our motivation for everything we do ourselves. Just to be remembered by God. We don't need to be remembered by man. All right, chapter 6. This will be the last chapter that we will cover here, and it's back to the main plot line, which is the reconstruction of the wall and the opposition Nehemiah has been facing along the way. And at this point in the story, Nehemiah has pretty much completed the wall. The only thing that's left to do is hang the doors. And Sanballat, at this point in time, and Tobiah, they have to throw whatever remaining ideas they have at Nehemiah in order to derail things. You know, so far, mocking, psychological warfare, plans for an ambush that didn't work. You know, what else is there to try? And in chapter 6, we get three back-to-back final attempts to defeat Nehemiah. First, foolishly optimistic, they just invite Nehemiah to stop by. They send over a messenger. They send him over four times, asking Nehemiah, hey, we should come have a discussion about this. But Nehemiah, not an idiot, refuses the invitation. And in verse 2, it says Nehemiah knew that they were planning to do him harm. So Nehemiah is fully prepared. He is walking with the Lord, and that'll be critical here in just a minute. Next on their list is to spin up a lie that they plan to deliver to the king. And we'll take a quick look at what this letter reads in verse 6 of chapter 6. They threatened to write this letter to Artaxerxes, and it was written, "It is heard among the nations, and Gashmu says," this is one of Sanballat and Tobiah's friends, "that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king, according to these words. You have also set up prophets to call out in Jerusalem concerning you. A king is in Judah. So now it will be heard by the king, according to these words. So now, come, let us take counsel together." I think as far as the threats and situations that Nehemiah has dealt with so far, this has got to be the easiest one. Because if you can think back, what was Nehemiah doing before he was in Jerusalem? You know, Nehemiah is saying, oh no, you're going to write a letter to the king. What did Nehemiah used to do? He used to work for the king. He used to help, feed the king. There's not a more trusted individual by Artaxerxes than Nehemiah. He was the cupbearer. If he wanted to rebel, if he wanted to become king himself, he should have killed the king when he was back in Susa. Nonetheless, Nehemiah prays to God for strength. Verse 9. "For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will become limp in doing the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands." So time after time after time, he hands it over to God. In times of preparation, in times of success, in times of opposition, every single time, Nehemiah calls on God. Finally then, the last attempt of Sanballat and Tobiah is to get Nehemiah to ruin this enormous reputation that he has established. What they do is they hire a prophetess on the inside to try to convince him to flee, to look like a coward in the light of the people. So what he should do is he should go to the temple, or this person's talking right to Nehemiah. You should go to the temple. You should lock yourself away because there's an attack. We got to protect you. You're our leader. This was in hopes that it would be seen by the people as cowardly and ruin his status. But because of Nehemiah's close relationship with the Lord, he recognized that this wasn't God's plan. And this is neat. I don't have more to expand on this tonight, at least, but Nehemiah was so in tune with what God wanted him to do that when somebody else claims to have guidance, he knows it's wrong. Verse 12, "Then I recognized that surely God had not sent him, but he spoke his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him." So this prophet was a fraud. And maybe, you know, he's let through the gates. People are listening to him. Nehemiah, you got to hear what this prophet has to say. But not Nehemiah. He doesn't fall for it. And Tobiah and Sanballat run out of ideas. And we finally come to the conclusion of our story. Verse 15 of Nehemiah chapter 6. "So the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Now it happened that when all of our enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, their confidence fell, and they knew that it was from our God that this work had been accomplished." So Nehemiah, with the hand of God, built a 2.5-mile-long wall in under 2 months. You know, people speculate about the dimensions, how thick, how tall, how long the wall was. It was a feat. This was an impressive work and done and accomplished only because of God's hand in it. And nothing, we know this, shuts up a critic like success. You know, the people that were just relentlessly mocking, threatening, and scheming against Nehemiah in the hopes of at least robbing them of some confidence, lose confidence themselves. The irony is perfect. Verse 16. Now it happened that when all of our nations, when all of our enemies heard it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, their confidence fell and they knew that it was from our God that this work had been accomplished. And I don't even need to address it, but I'm going to. I've done it 20 times. All the glory is given to God every single time to the very end. And something neat to note, it wasn't that, you know, Nehemiah said all glory to God and the people cheered and agreed with him. Instead, this project, these last few weeks have been a monument to God. The entire time, everybody witnessing it knew that this isn't possible by a group of Jews. This could only be the God of Israel and his hand. And they recognized that. The wall was a monument to faith in God's provision, so much so that even the enemies couldn't deny it. So, in rapid summary, that's Nehemiah 1 through 6. I hope that, you know, in addition to simply becoming more familiar with what your kids are learning this month in Children's Church and many other ministries throughout the week, I hope that we can see just how prayer works with action. That Nehemiah's prayer life can be an example of how we should pray, but also how we should prepare for our plans, and in the midst of our plans, pray, and after our plans, also pray. Prayer should be the place we turn to before, during, and after any activity in our lives. And just to use Nehemiah as an example, just to recap the last 6 chapters here, he prays when he receives news that makes him sad about Jerusalem. When he's mourning in chapter 1, he turns to God. Then in the months leading up to speaking with the king, in preparation for the most important meeting of his life, he's praying that God would grant him compassion before the king. Face to face with the king, he prays to God. When he's mocked by his enemies, he prays and hands the situation over to God to deal with. He prays that God would protect him from his enemy in the midst of his work. And just a moment ago, when Sanballat and Tobiah are bearing false witness against him, Nehemiah just prays to God. Now, it's easy to say, you know, pray at all times, but what I think is important for each of us to do individually is really define what all times really means. You know, pick out various parts of your life, your day, maybe your routine, that you would benefit from an increased reliance on God. And we can just use Nehemiah as a template. We can pray when we mourn. We should. We should pray when we are making plans. We should pray before these important meetings that we have. We should pray when we are wronged, when we are opposed. And then, after you have prayed, take action. Let's pray. God, thank you for this book. Thank you for Nehemiah and the narrative it is. Thank you for the encouraging and uplifting story of a man who just wants to accomplish your will, not for the praise of man or his own glory, but for yours. I pray that it's a reminder to us that as we go about our daily lives, as we make plans, that we would rely on you, that we would pray before, after, and during everything that we possibly do, that we would be an example to others, that we'd be praying with our kids, with our families, and in any situation that you bring us. I pray, though, that that wouldn't stunt us from making plans, that, you know, we would understand that you work in us and through us, and we just might be the answer to someone else's prayer. I pray that we would take action in the face of opposition, discouragement, mourning, whatever it is, so long as we're relying on you. In Christ's name, amen.